Yeah, I'm going to start. So allow me to welcome you to the inaugural session of Field Notes, Histories of Archaeology and Anthropology. My name is Allegra Fexell, and I'm a doctoral student in the Faculty of History, and I'm also one of three conveners of this graduate research group, along with Will and Julie from the Department of Anthropology, who is unfortunately away doing field work right now in Africa. But hopefully she'll be able to listen to this session online. So the purpose of this group is to bring attention to the histories of archaeology and anthropology and the scientific cultures in which they operated in a discussion that emphasizes cross-disciplinary discussion. And although our first term is largely focused on archaeology, we want to examine the histories of both archaeology and anthropology, the intellectual heritage, practices, and the challenges that both fields face, as well as the differences between them. We will be running a series of bi-weekly thematic reading groups and seminars, and Gabriel Mashenska has kindly agreed to give an introduction to the history of archaeology that will set a foundation for the coming weeks. Before I turn your attention to Will, I just want to add that as this is our first year, any comments or suggestions you may have about topics you'd like to explore or other things we might do, such as movie nights, are always appreciated. We'll also be sending out a weekly reminder in the Crash Digest about upcoming sessions, and of course, all talks and other relevant links will be posted on our blog and Facebook group. Thank you for coming.
Okay, so thanks, Allegra. Before Gabriel begins, I want to talk a little more about what the rationale behind setting this group up was. Over the last few years, interest in the histories of both archaeology and anthropology has gathered increasing pace. Such interest is not new. In 1973, Talal Assad's Anthropology in the Colonial Encounter addressed the historical links between that discipline and colonial practice. Said's Orientalism raised similar issues and also raised questions about how the study of the past of the region had developed. Yet these initial explorations have now both broadened and deepened. Within and without the disciplines whose history is being addressed, great concern is being attached to looking at those histories in detail. A work like Orientalism provided a starting point for some people, but how have archaeology or anthropology worked in practice? How do they develop as distinct entities, and have they in fact developed as distinct entities at all? There is a growing community of researchers addressing these and other issues, from those working within archaeology and anthropology themselves to those working in the history of science. We set up this group both to help bring that community together and also maybe to try and think about the questions that it needs to ask in order that its inquiries both continue to be and become more productive. To that end, we are running a series of thematically based seminars that hope to address the issues at stake. Meanwhile, Cambridge, and particularly Crash, seemed like the ideal place to do so. Not only is a vast amount of relevant research being done across the university, additionally, as the current Bible and Antiquity project at Crash shows, there is a community of interest here. Meanwhile, Cambridge is well placed. We can and have invited researchers from across the country to join in our discussions. Running this group here provides a unique opportunity, so thanks to Crash for funding it and to the various faculty advisors involved for supporting it. At the same time, and as Allegra said, we're also using various internet resources both to promote the group and to encourage discussion about it. Please do join our mailing list or check our Facebook page and even read our blog. We think the blog in particular could really serve as an interesting place for discussion, and we want to use it to do more than simply promote our event, so please stay tuned. I think that's enough from me. So without further ado, let me introduce Dr. Gabriel Mashenska, who is lecturer in public archaeology at the UCL Institute of Archaeology in London. Gabe's research interests range from archaeology as a community practice to the archaeology and anthropology of modern conflict. They also include an interest in the history of archaeology, and he has spent the previous 3 years as a Leverhulme Trust Early Career Research Fellow at UCL, addressing the development of public archaeology in relation to changing ideas of witnessing and audiences in the history of the natural sciences. He is well placed, then, to discuss the question, why histories of archaeology, and start this seminar series, and we hope to have a companion seminar on why histories of anthropology sometime next term. So, without further ado, please welcome Dr. Mashenska.
Thanks very much, Will and Allegra. As Will mentioned, I've only been a lecturer since Monday, actually. And in that time, I've squeezed in quite a lot of lecturing. They're working me hard. So I apologise if my voice starts to fade towards the end. It's a combination of lots of lecturing and lots of new students bringing their diseases from here, there and everywhere, which are ravaging my throat rather nastily, as they are all my colleagues as well, so I'm not feeling too bad. The title that I have here, Why Histories of Archaeology, is not one that I chose. It's one that was assigned to me, and it, I suppose it ought to have caused me to think hard about myself, my work, and why I do what I do, but it hasn't really, because I know why I do what I do, because it's ACE. But despite that, it's been a really interesting thing to think about over the last 15 minutes or so when I've been preparing this talk. And I am very happy for the opportunity to give the opening paper of this very interesting seminar series. There is a temptation in this kind of circumstance to review the history of archaeology, or even the history of the study of the history of archaeology. And a few years ago, I should have done that. But over the last decade, really, the history of archaeology and the study of the history of archaeology, I should say, has expanded dramatically in all kinds of new and exciting directions, and it would simply not be possible to speak about these developments and their place within the wider discipline and beyond in the short time I have available. This talk is not an advert or a recruitment exercise. I'm not trying to convert you all to the cause of the history of archaeology. I know some of you are already converts. Some of you have been working in the history of archaeology for a lot longer than I have. That's the point. Can I just check everyone's in the right room? Because I know there is a seminar going on next door, and if you're in the wrong room and you're feeling terribly embarrassed and don't want to walk out, it's fine. Now's the time. There's actually a little door in between. You can just scamper through at the back. But that's fine. I just thought I'd check. So this isn't an advert, nor am I trying to justify or defend what's still a fairly small and underdeveloped sub-discipline. Because it doesn't need defending. It's getting stronger all the time. There's interesting work coming from all the different directions, as I'm sure this seminar series will demonstrate. I think it's probably best to describe this talk then as a celebration of an area of intellectual activity which has brought me an enormous amount of enjoyment and intellectual stimulation, and which I'm convinced has the potential to open up new and exciting areas of research across the arts, humanities and social sciences as a whole and beyond. So I'm going to range quite widely over ideas and areas of the history of archaeology. The case studies that I'm going to be talking about are fairly broad, but quite a lot of them are from my own research, obviously, and from research carried out by colleagues friends of mine, mostly in the Histories of Archaeology Research Network, which I promised I would plug here. So, Histories of Archaeology Research Network, you heard it here first, largely based in Cambridge, around the work of the wonderful Pamela Jane Smith and others, and we've got a blog and a website. Everyone's got blogs these days, but, you know, we've got a blog and a website, and we do all kinds of exciting things, and have published a series of interesting small studies in the Antiquity Project Gallery, which I would thoroughly recommend you read, and I apologise if you read mine, it's slightly rude. Okay, that's quite enough. On with the talk. Thinking about the history of archaeology, I'm reminded of something I read a few years ago that was brought to my attention by my brother, who's in the room, on the anthropology of blood. And it was an interesting little article, and it began with the words that I really liked, which was, blood is never just blood. And in terms of anthropology and symbolism, of course, that's quite fairly obvious, but I'd like to say in the same way, the history of archaeology is never just the history of archaeology. Did I say anthropology? No. The history of archaeology is never just the history of archaeology. That's why it's interesting. That's why it's relevant within archaeology and beyond archaeology. To archaeologists, to historians of archaeology, to historians of other areas, other things, anyone really, with the slightest bit of interest in people and the world and stuff. So I'm going to talk about this in two parts, really. The first part of why histories of archaeology focuses on the why. The second part focuses on the why histories of archaeology. Because, of course, there is no single history of archaeology. And in that part, in that second part, I'll try and explain and demonstrate as well quite how many different areas of history are impacted upon and impact upon the history of archaeology, and why you can't ever think about it on its own, just as part of archaeology. So first up, why? Again, this is two questions as well. It's really asking that you can ask that separately of archaeology and everywhere else. So why should archaeology and archaeologists care about the history of archaeology in the first place? It's still the case at the moment that most historians of archaeology come from a background in archaeology. And this includes extremely prominent figures who are themselves important parts of the history of archaeology, participants in this study as well as observers, including people like Bruce Trigger and Leo Klein. At the same time, there's been a ever-growing amount of research in the history of archaeology by scholars with backgrounds in areas like intellectual history, history of science, and they've brought to the history of archaeology methodologies and analytical concepts that are really starting to revolutionise the subjects. This is an excellent and exciting time to be a historian of archaeology. So, but still, at the moment, as I said, this is mostly history of archaeology by archaeologists. I'm an archaeologist for the last 7 years, for example. I've run a small excavation in North London. It's been very exciting. You can forget everything you thought you knew already about Hendon in the 12th and 13th centuries AD. So, exciting times. But, as I say, I'm an archaeologist, and that's where I'm coming from with this. So why is history of archaeology important for archaeologists? Well, the most obvious reason really is if we don't understand our history, we will constantly repeat our history and reinvent the same ideas over and over again, which is in fact what has tended to happen throughout the history of archaeology. And partly this is because there has not been much scholarship or enough scholarship in the history of archaeology and the history of archaeological ideas until fairly recently. Partly, it's because everyone wants to be an innovator. So in the 1980s, with the rise of social archaeology and the idea that archaeology ought to be something which is socially engaged, political, explicitly allied to political ideologies, this was presented as something radical, iconoclastic. But it really was not particularly innovative at all. There was nothing there that had not been talked about by a variety of prominent archaeologists from the 1930s onwards. Even the arch-conservative Graham Clark in 1938 or so was saying that archaeology needs to become political to combat fascism in the world. So these ideas, these ancestors who are painted in very two-dimensional pictures. This tends to serve people who would like to think of themselves as radical and new and are not. Similarly, public archaeology, which is the area I work in primarily, has arguably actually declined enormously from the 1930s, when it peaked, and then declined as British archaeology in particular turned mostly towards rescue archaeology. And it was really only about 20 years ago that public archaeology began to be revived, and I would argue it's still catching up with where it was about 80 years ago. So we have much to learn from our ancestors and those who came before. An example of the history of archaeology repeating itself depressingly and unnecessarily is in the protection of archaeological resources during conflicts. As early as 1942, the famous archaeologist Mortimer Wheeler was complaining that armies spreading across North Africa were causing enormous damage to the extraordinary ancient Roman remains at Leptis Magna and elsewhere. And he complained not only were the monuments being despoiled in war, but that at home in England, in the House of Commons, MPs were giving entirely fallacious assurances that every possible precaution was in place to protect them. And Wheeler reserved his anger for the politicians who lied rather than the ignorant soldiers who were bombing and graffitiing monuments. Now that's a lesson that has not been learned 60 years on, when similar military activity in similar parts of the world is having similar impacts and similar lies are being told, which is a slightly depressing development, but again a reminder to learn from history and not repeat it. Excuse me. Another obvious area of interest in history of archaeology is in teaching, explaining that every area of archaeology has an ancestry, there are predecessors, and there are stories behind every technique and idea that are taught. So when we learn a field archaeology, we can learn about pit rivers and peat tree. When we learn Roman archaeology, we can learn about Roach, Smith and others, and the subjects can start to come alive. And some of the really excellent work in these areas comes from archaeological biographies and autobiographies. Some of the finest examples of these, I would say, are the autobiographies of Mortimer Wheeler, who I mentioned earlier, and Margaret Murray, who wrote a wonderful autobiography called My First 100 Years, which she wrote at the age of 99. I would again like to advertise the Histories of Archaeology Research Network here, and particularly Pamela's excellent Personal Histories project, which has carried out enormous numbers of all history interviews with prominent figures in history of archaeology and anthropology and related areas, and which is being used as a teaching a resource. I think even as I'm speaking here, actually, it's being used to introduce undergrads in archaeology. So there's an example there. But it's also interesting for us students and practitioners in archaeology and early career scholars in archaeology, because learning about people in archaeology illuminates career pathways that can otherwise appear quite opaque. Traditional career pathways and a less traditional career pathways. One of my colleagues has a professional background in carpentry and 80s popular music, which he would probably prefer to forget, but it's an interesting reminder that there are other areas of, there are other routes into archaeology than just degrees. I worked for a long time and I learnt a lot of my basic excavating techniques from someone who had been a digger driver on archaeological excavations and learnt archaeology by observing excavators around him, and then realised there was much more interesting things happening outside his digger, even if the pay was appallingly less than he was on at the time. History of archaeology for archaeologists also enables us to understand the world of archaeology, archaeological organisations, institutions. For example, the World Archaeological Congress, which is meeting early next year, has a quite amazingly complicated and controversial history, which has never quite been written in whole, but has illuminates the way in which ideas about archaeology were really battled over in the early 80s and onwards. Similarly, in my own research, I'm learning about the origins of peculiarities of why there is, for example, both a British Archaeological Association and a Royal Archaeological Institute, both of them doing fairly similar work over the last 160 years or more. And this, again, is revealing a history of strained personalities, politics, economics, class. These are things which remain opaque unless their history is carefully excavated. My own Department of Archaeology recently celebrated its 75th anniversary, and there have been histories and an exhibition on our history, and this has been a valuable and interesting exercise for staff and students in the department. I'm not convinced that anniversaries have particular interest, or if they're just an opportunity to mark our history. Jane Daniel famously authored the book 100 Years of Archaeology, and then only about 20 years afterwards he published the book 150 Years of Archaeology. So I think you really can just make them up as you go along, really. For students of archaeology, there's a real significance in understanding history to understand how the cutting edge of their area of research, which is where they ought to be aiming, has changed so much over the last 100 years or more. And that's an important part of locating your work in disciplinary context, understanding who came before, and again, making sure that you're not just repeating the past. Every specialism in archaeology, however a minor, has a history and a prehistory which are often exciting and illuminating. So the development of an archaeological conservation on excavations includes bizarre practices that would terrify conservators today, such as baking clay tablets in biscuit tins to preserve them in oil. Bizarre, but apparently it worked, and the British Museum is stuffed with them today, so it can't have gone completely wrong all the way. I think overall, though, for archaeology, good history of archaeology doesn't only lay foundations for contemporary work, it positively propels it. It demonstrates what's possible and what's been forgotten, and that is why history of archaeology is important for archaeologists. But that's, in a way, the easier part of my argument. In the second part, then, I'd like to talk about why history of archaeology for people who are not archaeologists, and particularly for people who are historians of anything else. And also, at the same time, why histories of archaeology, how many histories there are, and I refer back to the point I made earlier, the history of archaeology is many things, but is never only the history of archaeology. It is, in fact, pretty much any kind of history you can think of. Political history, cultural history, post-colonial, women's history, labour history, and more. An example of labour history of archaeology is Professor Stephen Quirk's recent research on Petrie and his native work forces in Egypt, the ways in which archaeologists are from Europe working in Egypt and elsewhere have employed local workmen, and the impact of these on the local economies and communities, and the ways in which, in Egypt in particular, archaeological excavation became an entire a livelihood for entire communities. And in Britain, as in the period slightly after this, there's been interesting research beginning on auto wheelers, labourers, and actually here there's a clear evolution. Excuse me one second. early on in his work in Wales, there was a large amount of unemployed miners available to excavate in the 1920s and onwards. And then from even only after, even in the 1930s, it became obvious that the era of the unskilled manual labourer was ending, that the availability of unskilled or semi-skilled agricultural labourers, which was a backbone of archaeology in these earlier periods, was declining. And this impacted archaeology, and this is part of the reason why there were increasing numbers of excavations using students rather than local labourers. But this can be, this is part of a larger trend in agricultural communities, in agricultural economies. And in this sense, archaeology is only illustrating part of larger trends in labour and economy in these rural areas. In other parts of the world, there are still fairly large manual labour work forces, but again, these are largely declining, and this is impacting on the practice of archaeology around the world. The history of archaeology is also political history on large scales and micro scales too. Tim Murray's work on early antiquities protection legislation demonstrated how their ultimate success depended in part on the declining power of the landowning rural aristocracy and the increasing power of the urban and industrial elite, and how these were changing patterns of power and influence in the parliament and elsewhere. More recent histories of archaeological policy and legislation are also demonstrating how networks of influence and power operate in archaeology and politics, and the ways in which archaeological legislation moved from state protectionism towards the current, not quite free market, a free for all, but almost. Most importantly, though, and this is something I would say is one of the most important universal aspects of the history of archaeology across the world, is that the history of archaeology is also the history of one of the most powerful forces in recent history, which is the educated middle class, which I think probably counts for most people here, by and large. But these are have been an absolutely transformative aspect of world history. The emergence of archaeology is the emergence of the urban middle class with leisure time and time to tour and educate themselves and their children. And this is the same around the world. Places where heritage is protected, where heritage attractions remain sustainable, are places where there is a middle class or enough middle class tourists to act as an imported middle class. And I think that's something which archaeologists tend to not ignore as such, but try to pretend can be elided, that there can be outreach projects, and there are, and they're excellent, and I've run them myself, but our core audience and our core constituency is this awesome and historically speaking aberrant phenomenon, the educated middle class. The history of archaeology is also colonial history and post-colonial history. Now, I imagine over the next term, when you get some more anthropologists in, they'll talk more about empire and colonialism. And it has tended to be regarded, I think, by me, for example, that archaeology is about nationalism, anthropology is about imperialism. So if you're building a country, you need archaeologists, because you need ancestors, you need a story of who you are and where you came from. And that's a recurring theme in the history of archaeology, and one of the areas which has been neglected in the last 20 years or so, but last 15 years, but was a very strong area, is the links between archaeology and nation building. Anthropology and empire is something to come back to, but I think the rise of archaeology in 19th century Europe pretty quickly spread out into the empires of the countries involved, Britain and France and Germany, for example. One of the major roles of archaeology, and a not terribly glorious one in these countries, was to deny indigenous people their history, to create alternative histories and stories of the prehistories and histories of the countries involved, where the local people were erased. A good example of this is southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, where a series of archaeologists went to quite staggering lengths to ensure that the monumental architecture of Great Zimbabwe, which is quite amazing medieval settlement in Zimbabwe, was attributed to pretty much any imaginable historical or mythical community other than the indigenous African population. It was attributed to Phoenicians, King Solomon and the Lost Tribes of Israel, anyone except the local people there. I mean, this was being done by and large by people who called themselves archaeologists. With one, I think there was one notable exception. I think Gertrude Tatum Thompson, who worked there, managed to ascribe the monument correctly, and she was then pretty much hounded out of the country by the local archaeologists because her answers were not acceptable. As for post-colonial history, what we see here is really a revival of the idea of archaeology as something which can provide post-imperial narratives, can provide national histories, can build new stories, can build museums, can create World Heritage sites and provide artifacts, images, monuments that can become icons of the country as it emerges. Again, Zimbabwe is a good example of that. Two icons of Zimbabwe which appear on their coinage, on their national flag in one case, and everywhere else on their national airline. Two things, the Great Zimbabwe, the monument there, and one of the most iconic artifacts from Great Zimbabwe, which is the Hope Stone carved birds of Great Zimbabwe, which are on absolutely every Zimbabwean thing you can think of. They were taken out of their archaeological context and used to define that country. They were used to brand it, if you like, around the world, inside the country and beyond. That's the power of archaeology. And the alternative is Mozambique, next door to Zimbabwe, which has on its flag instead a Kalashnikov, which is not as nice an image at all, but a bit more accurate image of how they became independent. So for colonial history and post-colonial history, this is fairly obvious, but the kind of research that's taking place in these things at the moment is very interesting, because it's like all good historical research, as it gets more developed, it becomes smaller and more specific. And a friend of mine is doing some fascinating research at the moment on the ways in which British treasure trove legislation was adopted in British colonies and ex-British colonies from the 18th century onwards, and the ways in which this impacts on archaeology in all of those countries, even now, and even after this country, we've actually erased those laws because they were arcane and, by and large, unworkable. One of the most interesting and important areas in the history of archaeology in the last few years has been the extremely large interest in women's history in archaeology. And this is quite an important area, because there have been a quite extraordinary number of extraordinary women in archaeology in Britain and abroad, for many of whom archaeology and archaeology abroad in particular was a way of at least partly escaping from the very restrictive worlds that existed for women throughout much of history. An example of a quite amazing woman in archaeology is Cambridge's own Dorothy Garrard, who became Disney Professor of Archaeology in Cambridge in 1939, which is a testament to her extraordinary scholarship, particularly when you consider that at that point there were no women admitted to the University of Cambridge at all. So her election as Disney Professor of Archaeology, which was partly done by external electors, caused a complete sea change in women's place at the University of Cambridge, and is an example of the ways in which the history of archaeology, or archaeology and archaeological ideas, have in the past driven the rest of the world forward as well. And I know that the integration of certain Cambridge colleges was not that straightforward at all, even much longer after 1939. Perhaps the less said there, the better, perhaps. And that's an area in which, as I say, in all of the areas I'm talking about, all of these aspects of history, there is enough to speak for hours, and I'm skimming over them appallingly and missing out enormous areas of incredibly interesting things. There is not the time in the world to talk about all these things as much as I would like to, so I apologise for the little snips you're getting before I pass on. And another area of history which is actually quite underdeveloped in the history of archaeology, perhaps because it's one of the areas we're not terribly proud of, is religious history. And this is where I think the trash project on the Bible and antiquity will be particularly interesting. Because throughout the history of archaeology, it has been driven by religion, and alternatively, it has in itself driven religion as well in various interesting and not always helpful manners. One particularly remarkable example is George Smith's discovery of the tablets, the clay tablets in Mesopotamia, which contain the story of a flood, which predated the narrative of the Old Testament. And this, as you can imagine, at the time, stirred things up quite a lot. And this was one of the things, alongside some quite excellent archaeological work, mostly coming out of Germany, where a lot of interesting biblical scholarship and archaeological work in the Middle East was taking place in the 19th century. And these arguably informed and helped to drive the emergence of the biblical criticism in the 19th century, the higher criticism in which the Bible was approached as a historical text rather than a holy one. So there was a role of archaeology in that. There was also a role for archaeology in the backlash and the emergence of the evangelical movement in particular. And that led to a vast amount of archaeology being paid for in various ways by evangelical Christians. And that's, in a way, as I say, it's part of the history of archaeology that a lot of people in archaeology would rather not talk about because it's slightly embarrassing, particularly some of the quite appalling research that emerged in this work in the early days, at least. And it's important to remember this is still a major source of funding for archaeology at the moment. It's amazing how easy it is to raise millions if you say you're going to go and find the resting place of Noah's Ark. Noah's Ark has been identified over and over again in different places all over the Middle East, and the expeditions to survey it, to excavate it, to bring parts of it back, have budgets that would make most archaeological field directors cry. So this still happens. Yes. I think one of the most important areas of where the history of archaeology can have an impact is in cultural history, broadly defined. The history of archaeological themes and metaphors in art and literature and other areas. To understand these things, to understand archaeological themes in artwork and literature, we need to understand the archaeology of that period, the state of archaeology in that time and place. So, for example, if we want to examine Thomas Brown's urn burial, it helps to know what kind of antiquarian research was taking place in Norfolk in the 17th century. This is key context to that. This is absolutely key context. And again, this research cuts both ways. Urn burial helps us understand antiquarianism. The history of antiquarianism helps us to understand literature. I've been doing some work of late on Kipling's archaeology, because Kipling wrote some quite extraordinary works that were inspired by the archaeology of the landscape that he inhabited in Sussex in particular. And he worked on the land, he didn't work himself, he employed people to work on the land, but he was a very enthusiastic student of archaeology. He was interested in the things that were emerging from the works on the land he owned, and the histories of the land that he was working on, the land he owned, rather, and where he was starting to spin his histories of England. And so, to understand the archaeological ideas he develops in works such as his poem A Land, was it The Land, and his Puck of Pook's Hill and those kind of stories there, where archaeological objects, archaeological monuments recur over and over. It's important to understand the artefacts he was discovering on the land there, most of which are still in his house. Something else I've been working on, which is slightly less elevated than these, but still interesting nonetheless, is the works of M.R. James, also a Cambridge man, who integrated an enormous amount of antiquarian and archaeological material into his 30 or so wonderfully scary ghost stories, for which he is most well known, despite his quite awesome record of actual research as well as his stories. I think he'd be quite outraged if he realised he was remembered this far just for scary stories and not for his research on biblical apocrypha and the stained glass and medieval manuscripts. But nonetheless, in working on his life history, and particularly his small but significant involvement in archaeology as a student, you can start to see immediately what no one who's looked at stories before has really looked at all, that the stories he wrote, particularly the ones about medieval history and archaeology, are very much informed by his own experience in taking part in medieval archaeological excavations in East Anglia. So again, to understand these things, to understand the archaeological themes and metaphors, we need to understand the archaeological history. Well, another person who made archaeology a very central part of his work is Freud, who wrote a lot using archaeological metaphors. And one of the interesting things about his work in psychoanalysis and the metaphors he used of archaeology is they're not good metaphors. They're not metaphors of someone who understands how archaeology actually happens. And this is because he never worked in archaeology. His involvement in archaeology was twofold, really. As a collector of artefacts, that demon spawn of on whose behalf archaeological sites around the world are destroyed and objects ripped out of their context. So he was a collector of artifacts, so he was interested in objects as objects. But also he was fascinated with the site of Pompeii. And a lot of the metaphors of archaeology that he used in his writings are based on the idea that in archaeology you excavate away layer after layer, underneath which everything that that was there before in your mind is perfectly preserved. It's just there as it was originally. There's no taphonomic processes tearing them apart, flattening them, squashing them, wearing them away. They're all there. So again, he talked about archaeology. He referred to himself repeatedly in his work as an archaeologist, digging down. But actually, his own experiences of archaeology or lack of experience of them, is part of the reason why his metaphors are so appallingly bad. I would like to talk about the history of archaeological publishing, but I'm running out of time here. But on just a quick word on archaeological biography and autobiography, because just as the history of archaeology is not only the history of archaeology, no archaeologist is only an archaeologist. And to understand these people and their lives and their work in archaeology, we also need to understand everything they were that was not an archaeologist. So to understand Mortimer Wheeler as an archaeologist, it helps to understand him as a husband, which he was repeatedly and imperfectly. And I would highly recommend a book which has just been published, a biography of his first wife, which is a really excellent work and explains quite how much of his work in archaeology is actually hers, which is a recurring theme, again, not only in archaeology, behind every great man and all that. But another important thing to understand him and the quite manic way in which he worked is to understand him as a survivor of the First World War, or as he regarded himself, as he was, the only survivor of a certain generation of young archaeologists who were beginning to work in archaeology before the First World War. There weren't that many. The world of archaeology in Britain at the time was very small. They all pretty much went to war. He came back. And arguably, again, this is open to interpretation, but arguably, as he claimed, the reason why he worked so manically, the reason why he felt he had to almost single-handedly rebuild the world of archaeology, archaeological skills, is that he was suffering from survivor guilt, and he had this idea that he had to bear the burden of this lost generation of archaeologists. And again, to understand the places he worked and the sites he dug and why, it helps to understand that he was lower middle class. He didn't have an independent income. He lived in reasonably impoverished circumstances for most of his professional career. To understand him as a person, as a husband, as a traumatised ex-serviceman is very important. Without that, we cannot really understand his career in archaeology. And equally, his careers as a military man, as an administrator of things like the British Academy, have interest and significance beyond the world of archaeology. Now, I'm really running out of time here, so I'm skipping through what looked like very interesting stuff. Never mind. Invite me back again and you'll get episode 2, where I talk about more embarrassing people and their personal lives. But I think from what I've just described there, it should be clear that the histories of archaeology and the numerous different histories and historical ideas with which it overlaps can best be understood as mutually constitutive. A better understanding of any part of of these histories, of the histories of archaeology and the things with which they overlap. A better understanding of any part of that brings with it a better understanding of the whole. So I've started to give some idea here of the history of archaeology as a fascinating, I hope, cocktail of individuals, places, institutions, networks, nations, legal systems, ethnic and religious communities, ideas, objects, actions, and contexts. The history of archaeology... Hell, no. Archaeology has illuminated and continues to illuminate a category of human activity that has transformed our understanding of ourselves and our place in the world for hundreds of years. That's reason enough for the history of archaeology. It's fundamentally interesting. We're standing here in the middle of a university. Things being interesting ought to be enough. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Gabe.
You're welcome.
We've got about 50 minutes left, so I'm not sure if we're going to use up all the time, but we can just lay it open to questions, I guess, and if you just want to take...
Yeah, again, if anyone would like me to expand on anything that I skipped over, you felt too quickly, I'd be happy to do that. If there are entire areas you think I've not thought of yet... you think you'd like to raise, I'd really like that, because, as I say, this is all a work in progress. No? I got it all. Oh, sorry, first and second.
Well, I was only just going to leave here at this point, because I'm actually not an archaeologist. I'm a musicologist, so I'm really into music, so traditionally more associated with anthropology. But I just was struck when you started to mention Freud and archaeology of metaphor, because actually, this is a huge field, and probably where archaeology is sort of revealed in the most blurred and vague way, but the idea of, particularly in relation to memory studies, using archaeological, you find archaeological metaphors used right, left and centre across the disciplines and in literature as well. Just because of the romantic and sort of very, it's just a very apt idea when you're talking about memory and also amnesia, just the simply the idea of layers and possible seepage between layers and erasure of layers. I just wanted to point out that this is a huge world of popular popular academic or intellectual usage of and archaeology of metaphor.
Absolutely, that's something I've worked on quite a lot, on memory and metaphors of memory. Yeah. It is a fascinating area, and it's, as you say, it's endless. You can work on that forever. And some of the things which recur, as you say, are ideas of depth, burial, layering, but also the idea, and I think it's quite important in memory studies, where agency is almost always neglected. Actually, that's a slight exaggeration, but there's a lot of time memory is treated as a thing which floats around on its own, doing its own thing. But the idea of remembering as an act, like excavating, and that's a common thing as well, to say I'm digging into my past, digging into my memories, or alternatively burying things. But the idea that these processes are active and involve someone's agency are quite important. At the same time, I mean, as you say, it's everywhere, but it helps to understand more about what the people using that metaphor mean, if we can have some idea of where their understanding of archaeology comes from.
And also to correct willful erasure as well. The idea that it's not just memory, it's the reverse. It's erasure of memory for all sorts of reasons. And how, by all the sort of archaeology as a potential corrective for that. Anyway, just to sort of...
No, I mean, these are all areas, hugely interesting areas. One of the things I work on a lot is the archaeology of modern conflict, where you have an enormous amount of people aiming to erase histories they find inconvenient. Erasing, but also, I mean, more violently through destroying these monuments rather than just rewriting the histories. And that's something, again, where archaeology, particularly archaeology of human rights abuses, is there's some really interesting things there where these ideas of archaeology and memory are really coming together and becoming very closely intertwined there. Sorry, there's a question over there.
Oh, it was just, you skipped right over the history of publishing archaeology.
Yes. Sorry, no, I would have liked to have talked more there. But, I mean, that's quite fascinating because there are aspects, there are places where archaeological publishing has really propelled new ideas in publishing. Layard's History of Nineveh and its Remains is one of the first books sold by W.H. Smith on railways, and that became a very large area of publishing. Similarly, quite a lot of the most successful earlier Pelican books were archaeological, and there's been some excellent research on the Pelican book published by Jordan Child, and I think it was Man Makes Himself. Is that Pelican? And that was, I believe, a book that was used as a, I can't remember where I heard this, a way of members of the Communist Party or Communist sympathisers in the British Army in the Second World War were recognising each other, because you had a copy of it sticking out of the pocket of your uniform, but they fit perfectly. The books were made, or the pockets were made to fit perfectly, so you could carry the books around with you. It would have your little Gordon Child sticking out, and that was that. But and I mean, again, there's quite a lot of early archaeology texts, or rather early antiquarian texts, that were some of the first books printed by 19th century printing clubs when those started to get going. And that was a really a whole new area of archaeological, of historical scholarship and publishing there. And some of those antiquarian texts were rescued from obscurity because they were rescued by printing clubs and printed by subscription, but which was made possible by the fact that there was an emerging community of archaeologists and antiquarians in Britain in the early 19th century. So that's some of the things that, again, that's an area I'm very interested in and I'd love to do more work in. So it's there's lots of potential there. Quite a lot of publishers' archives that have only just started to look at the potential there. So exciting times.
Do you think I'm just playing devil's advocate? There was a case last 2 years ago where amongst our colleagues, two of them were very close to litigation against each other. One thought the other was stepping on each other's archive. They can remain nameless. But there is a slightly interesting issue about the scale of our political archives. And I wonder if you could make the argument that if it, the discipline as the sub-discipline of the history of archaeology current rate it's at, whether within 20 years' time it would largely have exhausted itself. Because its ranges of sources at the same time are fairly limited, the range range of major individuals. And then when you start getting into the second and third ranks of leading individuals, the sense of how intellectually interesting they really are becomes an issue. And that would only be in a European context, because of course it changes. But it's it is the sense of how the limitation of sources, and then of course it becomes interesting, I think, equally about whether modern archaeology is actually interesting, especially its academic constitution. Like, you know, having done quite a lot of work in the history of archaeology, most academics are actually not very interesting because they're professionally academic. And that becomes a kind of stone wall within our own histories, I think, the sense of that it isn't going to be ever expanding, or suddenly when you get to the sense of generations that have all been grouped in by their output is grouped by the RAF and their backgrounds are simply largely the same. You know, it seems to me that the history of archaeology might sort of run off the rails at that point, or at least be rather tedious.
Hmm.
I was wondering if you think it is an unlimited project.
Well, I like your... I think it's a very idealistic view that history stops when it stops being interesting. If that was the case, I could think of whole areas of history that would have stopped long, long, long ago, but they keep churning on. In terms of resources, I think you're being slightly unfair. I mean, even if the field of the history of archaeology continues to expand at the rate it's been expanding, which has been quite impressive at ACE, it's still small, and it's the resources. I mean, you talk about biographies. Yes, that's certainly one area which is, if not exhausted, exhaustible. But then, of course, you've got beyond biographies of individuals, there are biographies of communities and institutions, and that's the kind of thing that the Personal Histories Project is working on quite well as well. There is the histories of particular excavations and projects. There's archaeological histories of sort of areas that were worked. And then all of the areas that I've sort of tagged up here, so labour histories of archaeology. There's been no work in this country really on archaeological workforces, or just a few tiny little bits.
Well, that's why I was giving you. I was still giving in 20 years.
Oh, thank you, yeah. Thank you.
But it's still the same that, you know, I mean, it is interesting, having worked along in archives, that, you know, if you take something like the Jones Archive of Monty, or you take Frank, you know, like something like the Museum of London Professional Archives, site archives are essentially not, you know, they're a professional archive. They're not, you know, they're not really very interesting. They're interesting for their archaeology, but not their content.
Well, that's...
And, of course, you have the Institute itself, which is a rather interesting phenomenon. But it's kind of a different constitution.
Oh, I mean, well, the Institute of Archaeology, I mean, our archives...
Museum of Archaeology,
sorry. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I don't know about their archives, but the Institute of Archaeology archives will take 20 years to get them into a state where they're workable, where any historian can actually get anything out of them. They're so badly run by UCL Special Collections. You heard it here first. It's on record, too. Damn you. But I think, I mean, it can expand in lots of different directions, but I think the idea that a lot of excavation archives are not historically interesting only holds if you treat them as clearly delineated things, as they've been archived. As you know, what gets archived is the archive, when actually, of course, there's the personal materials relating to all the people that took part in those things. And one of the... I think one area that it would be quite amusing if it expanded, but it would also be of much more value to archaeology than pretty much anything that's happened up till now, is if we could really expand what I believe you started to do more than anyone else, which is bringing together the history of archaeology with post-excavation research and writing up, because there are so many excavations that are not written up, that are not properly recorded. For those of you who aren't archaeologists, I'm really... this is our dirty laundry being aired in public here slightly. But there's enough excavations that have not been written up that could be approached, at least in the first case, by a historian who could get plenty out of them and put plenty in, maybe leave the archive in a more workable state than it was in the first place. And that would involve really sort of blurring the boundaries, as again, as you've started to do, of documentary archives, material archives, photographic and image archives, and the material that relates to the individuals who took part, their notebooks and diaries and autobiographies. So I think, in a sense, yeah, the next 20 years are going to be interesting, but we are not going to run out of stuff at all, far from it. I think what will happen is it will get more and more complicated, and what we'll hopefully see is more and more collaborative research, people working together on large things, rather than what you have now, which is inevitable for a project in its early, for a discipline, I should say, in its early years, which is everyone pinging around doing things that they find exciting or stimulating, or which are low-hanging fruit.
So my attempt to doing that would be quite interesting at some point to review the area
Pardon?
The area project, the European Archives project, which had a huge amount of funding as a group thing. And it would be interesting to consider the output at some point. Now is not the appropriate time. But perhaps, you know, there was quite a sustained activity on that. Its degree, you know, and the degree of archiving that was made available.
No, I absolutely agree, and this is probably exactly the place where one ought to whisper quite loudly that large amounts of European money doesn't always bring amazing results. But yeah, absolutely. But then I still think, I mean, maybe I'm being overly charitable, but I still think this is, if we think of the early period of archaeology, when it was mostly antiquarians making lists and typologies, because that was arguably what needed to be, in retrospect, in a horribly teleological view, that needed to take place so that archaeology could mature and become what it is now. You could say that the history of archaeology is still in an early stage where we need to at least start to delineate what's there, before we can start to strategize or work on things that are more structural to the field as a whole.
I was wondering how this increased interest in kind of personal histories and history of archaeology is trickling down the university system. So, I mean, is there an increase in graduate students studying it, and is there a subsequent kind of, is it getting covered more in undergraduate courses,
for example, now than previously, because of this kind of increased research interest and money being pumped in at the top?
Do you know anything about that?
Well, yes. There isn't that much more money being pumped in at the top. Would that there were. But yes, it is starting to trickle down. And it's interesting, there's still very few, if any, dedicated undergraduate or postgraduate course modules on the history of archaeology. But that's not far away. I mean, my knowledge of this mostly comes from my involvement in the histories of archaeology research network, which, when it started up 5 years ago, was it? When did we get going? 5 years ago-ish, was virtually all postgrads. Now, quite a number of us have got lecturing jobs around the world, and are starting to develop courses in the history of archaeology. Now, as early career people, we can't necessarily say, I'm going to do a course on this, and be told, yes, you can do a course on that, you do what you're damn well told to do. But it will start to expand, yes. Everything's in place for it to start to develop and start to expand. And but already, despite that, yes, as well as that, things like these personal histories and the kinds of things that they've produced, the resources they produce, that's been hugely that's been received extremely well by undergraduates. The audiences of these events are large numbers of undergraduates, particularly here. There's been a real concerted effort at this university to bring undergraduates in so that they understand where the underlying foundations of the discipline are. And that's been a really successful thing. And the involvement of undergraduate students in those history projects has been a really important aspect as well. So if that continues to expand beyond this university as it has started to, yes, then yeah, it will start to have much more impact on undergraduates and their teaching and their whole experience. And it will make them, I think, better archaeologists, hopefully. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
I hope so. Sorry, I just realised I've been ranting slightly and I've lost track. Oh, go on.
There's a thing, one interesting question is whether a degree of historic consciousness now propels academia. Because if you talk to most academics, none have any time to read any books anymore, because they're all generating so much for the REF. So they know that they're not reading each other's books. And most of them know that their colleagues aren't reading their books either. Not to be, once you're out of the early lecture stage, and I think it's done. But it becomes quite interesting that whether within the historic consciousness of the discipline, either that you have once the greats are established, you very much have it in Cambridge, the sense of measure of the past. And of course Cambridge was always kind of disappointed, never quite up to the standard of that it was in Graham Clark's day. We'll never have that world agenda that's simply gone. And of course the world changes so much that, you know, of course one institution can never be that important. One individual can't. That as archaeology democratizes and becomes more and more dispersed, our individual books are, you know, there's not a world site anymore, no matter how much we might try with Chavahoya. It just won't have that status anymore because there's now regional archaeologies, the way that there are histories of archaeology. So everything effectively democratizes. And the natural things, the things don't have that status. But I think many academics have that kind of sense that the justification for what they do will come out in the annals of time, that sometime academics in the future will be able to read books and historic consciousness and understand their value for what they were, but it's not constituted in the contemporary agenda at the same time. I think it is quite interesting what an awareness of, a very conscious awareness of history and discipline does to modern practices.
I think you can probably be aware of your contemporary worthlessness without a historical awareness. But, I'm not sure. I mean, I completely agree that people are, most of us are writing things that no one ever reads, and why would they want to anyway? But I don't think most academics care too much about that as long as they got their REF submissions. But I do think that same thing might be one of the reasons why there's such interest in the history of archaeology, is that people are feeling nostalgic now for the time when all the archaeologists in Britain were on first-name terms with all the other ones. They might have hated each other, but they knew who they were.
And books counted.
And it was easier to write a book as well, because you could just go out and look at some things and catalogue them, and John Murray would publish it, and you sell, dozens of copies. I think that there is a nostalgia to that, because archaeology, particularly for people getting into it now, is not what it used to be in terms of opportunities to take part in exciting, groundbreaking excavations while you're an undergraduate. Opportunities for volunteering are what they are, and you have to know about computers now, and that's horrible. So I think there is a nostalgia that is driving.
It must happen to a lot of disciplines, that sense of modernly constituted disciplines, when they gain a sense of historic consciousness. Same way as when institutions do, be it the Institute or Cambridge here, the sense that it's no longer just something constituted in the present, but the weight of its own past begins to bear on. So.
I think it would be interesting to look back in archaeology at the period around what Clark called the loss of innocence, and see what kind of histories, I mean, the histories he wrote are interesting enough in their own right, really, but to see, what kinds of histories of archaeology were being written at times when archaeology was much more self-consciously in a period of transformation or crisis. So, early 80s, for example, what kinds of histories emerged then, if any? I can't think of any off the top of my head, but actually that was still Glyn Daniels era, and he was merely ignoring.
And I think when Andrew Cooper started giving the prehistorics lecture on the 17th of London, because in her sort of oral history, that the degree which she's taken it up, I know it's up to 1970s and up to 1980s practices of what she's going to be presenting. And that would have come into taking a wider book.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I've not really thought about, is using the history of archaeology to diagnose all the things that are unhappy in the world of archaeology. But that's a very, no, that's a very, very important part, because that's part of, again, of it as a history, as a critique, which has got much more interest, inherent interest, than history as light entertainment, which is what a lot of the history of archaeology has always been. I mean, like all these things, you know, we can turn it into an amazing critique, and we'll write it into an amazing book, which no one will ever read, and then we can add that to the pile. But at least we'd mean well. Yeah.
You know what you're working at, you know what's there, and you can handle it. And the other thing that struck me is, because I definitely do find there is a sort of an increasing self-consciousness of the past in quite pervasive in academia. And do you think it has something to do with multidisciplinarity, and really just sort of wanting to sort of step back and in a way legitimize one's own identity? Something to do with that. I mean, we're so encouraged to think that we're not really just what we are, and we're all now everything. I mean, isn't there just a sense that we actually want to legitimize, and even for practical purposes, you know, for funding, and because at the same time we're all struggling for our patch of resources, and for that we have to actually reclaim our own identity.
Yes, I mean, I think that's a really
perceptive
idea.
Project in microcosm.
Yes, but it is this idea that once you start to stray further from home in an intellectual sense, it helps to sort of turn around and remember what that home is,
and to remind others,
and also the way that tends to bear out is that, of course, when you start to move and work in between disciplines, you become more self-conscious about the fact that you work in a department of X, and you did your degree in a department of X, and that those departments have got a history. The people who taught you there are part of a history that you are then a part of it as well. And that can seem, looking back, maybe through rose-tinted glasses, that it's got a coherence and a clear narrative that is lacking now. And if we think that that's what most people want from a history, any kind of history, is a story with a clear beginning and middle and end, and particularly for you yourself, you want to have that ancestry clear, well-defined and long, if possible. So that yes, it makes perfect sense to me that once that ground beneath your feet starts to move, like become less secure, and it hasn't really changed much in universities. I mean, for all we're told, everyone's interdisciplinary now. The disciplinary, you know, the department's still departments. Only a few universities have done what I think Arizona State have done, which is completely destroy all existing departments and reinvent them in new cross-disciplinary kind of structure. That's not going to happen anywhere else for very long, because people don't like change as a whole. But that, as long as those kind of changes aren't taking place, there will be the structures in place that remind us of this past, these legacies of the past, the buildings even. And all those things, yes, will kind of lead people to remember how it used to be when archaeologists were just, you know, people with hats and spades going around the world finding great things.
It is interesting, though, because it sounds to me, you know, the one thing all the humanities share archive fever generally, so it's no wonder we have the overlap. But when one looks at the origins, it seems to me that part of there's a twofold process going on. Because one hand is a natural desire to want to break down the traditional story, increasingly go to sort of more and more little bits of the red herrings that have been neglected. But at the same time, it's quite interesting, I think, in terms of the discipline generally, that one of the things about it, when you use the history of archaeology, it also feeds you into key intellectual history. It's part of what makes archaeology an intellectual discipline, and not just performance, discovery, or something like that. And the one difficulty often when one breaks down too much of the traditional story, you actually risk losing that intellectual core, which I think is quite a propulsion of recognizing the overall project of archaeology, or whether it's anthropology, etc., is that sense of its intellectual origins. And the history does take you back to that. Sometimes the way it's practiced, because you can't focus on the breaking down the core story, can somewhat cut at the edges of that.
Yep.
Yeah. No, I just think, you know, that sense of key issues of, you know, the main roles of archaeology in terms of evolution, or multiple stories of, you know, multiple origins of agriculture, multiple origins of urbanism. Those really key discoveries, they still are, you know, important in terms of the intellectual canon of the West. And those are, you know, key, prime, important achievements, which we, you know, as the role of archaeology increasingly changes in the present, you can lose sight of it quite easily.
So those are things that now's the time in sort of... So I suppose, again, you're making the point, and this is... nostalgic exercise.
No, it's not just nostalgic, because it is part of it. It is part of the rootedness of it. You know, the sense of, you know, whether you can say that the practice today of archaeology, even academically, is an intellectual pastime as opposed to an academic pastime. Those two have got divorced in terms of relationship to key questions. But the sense of certainly it was once, and it's important to. Relationship to those key objects, and that's not just nostalgic.
I mean, I suppose one thing we can do in archaeology, when we're a bit concerned about finding more interesting ideas and interesting ways of doing things, we can do what we've always done, which is look at what geographers were doing 15 years ago and do that. And I'd be interested to see if these kind of arguments and these kind of discussions are happening in other disciplines, but geography in particular, because they're always, I'm not kidding, they always are that far ahead. So I bet there are lots of very similar ideas, similar arguments, and similar institutional structures that exist where we could learn a lot from that and how those processes are taking place. And they're better organised in terms of organisations as well. I should have been a geographer. they got it good over there. But no, I think, yeah, you, there's so much we need to... Yeah, that it would be nice to walk around departments of archaeology grabbing people by the collars and shaking them and saying, think like a damned intellectual, goddamn you. Like the intellectual you once were. Possible. Yeah.
I must remember here that there is a seminar series and social anthropology, and it was about the concept of gardens and the cross culture between art, and this was the late 80s, and it was archaeology combined with social anthropology. And Jeff Bailey stood up and gave the most extraordinary talk, which was this, in the sense of archaeology's incredible sense of historic and future consciousness. I see archaeology as a 10,000-year-long project, and we've only just put our foot across the door and know nothing. And it took the anthropologists to jump on, social anthropologists, and they've done their entire work. Think of what you've achieved. There is no world-changing subject matter of what archaeology achieved, you know, by the beginning of the 20th century. It was actually quite interesting to hear somebody else apart from this, because that sense of an incredible future dimension is almost the same spin of the
Yeah, this is exactly the kind of things that undergraduates ought to be hearing and aren't. On that depressing note.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave. We have another seminar in 2 weeks' time, and it's Matthew Eddy from the University of Durham talking about the Enlightenment. If you look on our website, if you look on the Crash website, and if you look on our blog, which is crashfieldnotes.wordpress.com, there are details, and there will be more details and more stuff. So thanks, and thanks to Gabe.
And thank you for a really interesting discussion as well. This has been great.